Questions a little bit on the multiplicity of the people in heaven, and Beatrice says, "Behold how great the white-robed company! Look on our city, see its gyres full spread. Behold our thrones that are so nigh complete. New souls they lack for whom they're covenanted." Now they're just lots and lots of rooms and thrones and places and turrets and you can't imagine how much room there is in heaven. And all for different kinds of people. Now the interesting thing is that when he discusses paradise, he talks about the problem that you have in communicating in heaven. Now, how are you going to be able to talk? How do angels talk to each other? How can you communicate with God when you're in that place? We can communicate with Jesus Christ because he became incarnate, so we could. But now God is just ever, he's a being, and how do we get so we can talk to him? And Dante uses in a couple places instances where he talks about the fact that, no, you can't really get inside of a dog or a cat and talk. I mean, how can you converse with them? You can't. Well, then how do you? And we can't make them talk to us. We can communicate, but not really speak. And so he talks about heaven and the fact that one of the great things that's going to happen to us in heaven is that we are going to be ingodded. Now that is actually a literal translation of an Italian word. That God is going to put his pattern on us, his power in us, his glory in us in such a way that we are going to be able to speak to him. We're going to be able to have his language. You know, that's really an exciting thing to think about. But that's going to be one of the privileges and the glories. But you see, this goes quite a ways beyond where we usually sit, right? You know, we don't usually think much about this vision of eternity and paradise, and, you know, you think about the angels all having their hair done the same way, you know, that's the way most of these angelic choruses look. They all look like men, have their hair waved, not maybe the same way mine is, but so good. But, you know, you see all these little girly angels, I don't know where we picked that up, but it certainly is strange, because the way the angels, the feeling you get from the angels is one of sort of fear. I mean, look at Mary, you know, when the angel came to her, didn't have a nice cozy little chair or something. Hey, Mary, I'm stupid for you, you know. Boy, an angel came in, and you got a feeling of, whew, what's happening? And you know, we do have a kind of a, I suppose we've done it to protect ourselves from the fright of heaven, but there is a real respect and awe and exciting kind of fright that we ought to have in thinking about what a place, what a thing, what a life to live that has that kind of a spin-off at the end, because it's a spin-off into another beginning. Well, anyway. I do want to spend a little bit of time in hell, because otherwise you won't appreciate heaven. But there are some things about the way in which Dante talks about the inferno, that the things he says in the inferno that really speak so quickly to our condition. I guess our condition is a little more in that realm than it is in the paradise condition, as of now, anyway. Because it just seems to me that a lot of places that he, just by the turn of a phrase, he's able to pick you up and say, that's where I am. That's just exactly what I would do. And I'm going to read a couple of them to you and see if you don't think that this is true. The one thing about hell that is clear, the whole inferno, is you don't feel, as I said, that this is an arbitrary kind of punishment. People who went to hell in the Divine Comedy, and people who go to hell now, and who people who will continue to go to hell in the future, go there because of their own choice. Oh, you say, that's not possible, because anybody in their right mind would never do that. Well, just think about Bedazzled. Remember what that poor guy went through, you know, and he thought he was making such good choices all the time, and got fooled every single time by everything that happened. And finally he realized, no, I'm not going to let you give me a choice anymore, because you put me in such a fuzzy state. When I'm going to make a choice, I don't know what kind of choice to make. Well, this is what Dante says does happen to people, but it happens to them because they want it to happen. They choose to have it happen. And I'm going to read them the first canto is a beautiful one, but I don't want to take time with that. I want to read the passage about Francesca and Paolo. I don't know how many of you know the music, Francesco de Rimini. It's a beautiful, beautiful, romantic orchestration. And I remember when I heard it a long time ago, and I hadn't read the comedy at that time, but I knew that it was about a disappointed love affair, and I thought, oh, this was so romantic and so beautiful. Well, this is the way Dante felt too, and he was very, very tender in the way in which he talks about this. They descend from the first circle, and they're going into the second one, and these are the circles of incontinence in hell. And he says here, "And now the sounds of grief begin to fill my ear. I'm come where cries of anguish smite my shrinking sense, and lamentation shrill. A place made dumb of every glimmer of light, which bellows like tempestuous ocean burling in the batter of a two-way wind's buffet and fight. The blast of hell that never rests from whirling harries the spirits along in the sweep of its swath, and vexes them forever beating and hurling." And you get the feeling from the inferno that it's so noisy, and there's so much, you know, noise of wind and a kind of a wind that actually has a demonic, heated kind of a spirit in it that really wants to pummel you and beat you. And that's what you get from those lines. "When they were borne to the rim of the ruinous past, with cry and wail and shriek, they are caught by the dust, railing and cursing the power of the Lord's wrath. Into this torment, carnal sinners are thrust, so I was told. The sinners who make their reason bond thrall under the yoke of their lust." Now I'm going to explain that, because it's hard to listen to that in a poem. "They make their reason the bond of their lust." Now you remember what I said about the guardians at the threshold of the subconscious, that, you know, that you've got all this stuff going down inside you, and a lot of it could come up, you know, and really put your life into a real turmoil if you let it. But there are guardians at the threshold that are alert, and it should alert you, so that if you are tempted, you're not going to let that temptation take over and say, that wasn't so bad, was it? You know, and then before you know it, you've slid into hell. And this is what he says. He says, "They make their reason bond thrall under the yoke of their lust," so that they even rationalize their position, so that they say, "Well, I sinned, but it really wasn't my fault. It was because of this and this and this." But you see, it isn't doing them any good. You could justify yourself all over the place if the sin has been committed. You know, it's like deciding after somebody's been killed whose fault it was. It's not going to do much good for the person that was killed, is it? Well, usually, it's in hell, you know, it is always our fault that we're there. Life is the starling's wheel. You know what starlings are?
Mm-hmm. They're birds.
Birds, right. Life is the starling's wheel in the winter season in wide and clustering flocks, wind-borne. Even so they go, the souls who did this treason. They're just like birds that are blown. And they wheel, and they wheel, and they turn, and they twist, hither and thither, and up and down, outworn, hopeless of any rest. Rest, did I say? Of the least diminishing of their pangs forlorn, and as the cranes go chanting their harsh lay across the sky, in long procession trailing, so I beheld some shadows borne my way, driven on the blast, and uttering wail on wailing. Therefore I said, O master, and he's talking to Virgil, art thou able to name these spirits thrashed by the black winds flailing? And then he lists a whole lot of really bad people with a lot of bad reputations, like Tristram and Isolde and Semiramis and Dido and Helen of Troy and so on. And then Dante sees somebody he recognizes. Poet, said I. Fain would I speak those two that seem to ride as light as any foam, and hand in hand on the dark wind drifting go. And he replied, wait till they nearer Rome. And you know, have you ever watched, you know, if you wait for something to come around, it's whirling and whirling, you gotta wait till it comes down closer to you before you can catch it. And this is the way these soldiers, they were going round and round and round. And Virgil says, gotta wait till they get a little closer to you. When they blow down in nearer to you, then you can talk to them. Can't talk to them over that all that noise and all that whirlwind. So they eddied past on the whirling tide, and I raised my voice, O souls that rarely rove, come to us, speak to us. And as desire waxed homeward, dove with dove to their sweet nest, on raised and steady wing, down dropping through the air, impelled by love, so these from Dido's flock come fluttering, and dropping toward us down the cruel wind, such power within my affectionate summoning. And then Francesca said, oh, so kind of you to come down here and talk to us. Oh, I wish that other people would be so glad to talk to people and explain our position. And then she said, there's a town upon the sea coast near where the Po with all his streams come down to rest in the ocean. I was born there. Love that so soon takes hold in the gentle breast took this lad, this is a lad that's floating around with her, took this lad with the lovely body they tore from me. The way of it leaves me still distressed. Love that to no loved heart remits love's score took me with such great joy of him that see, it holds me yet, never shall leave me more. She's going to stay with him, you know. Well, she really is going to stay with him, and that's not a lie. Love to a single death brought him and me. Cain's place lies waiting for our murderer now. These words came wafted to us plaintively. Hearing those wounded souls, I bent my brow downward, and thus bemused, I let time pass till the poet said at length, what thinkest thou? Now this is the sloppy, romantic, sentimental way we deal with things. You know, Don said, oh, it's just too bad, you know, they really loved each other. Wasn't that all right? Isn't love what makes the world go round? When I could answer, I began, alas, sweet thoughts, how many, and desire, how great, brought down these twain under the dolorous path. And then I turned to them. Thy dreadful fate, Francesca, makes me weep. It so inspires pity, said I, and grief, compassion. Tell me, how and by what did love his power disclose and grant you knowledge of your hidden fires? And then she says, well, if you want to know the truth, I'll be as those who weep and who confess. One day we read for pastime how enthralled Lord Lancelot lay to love. We blame the British for this one. Okay. Lord Lancelot lay to love who loved the queen. I'm sure you saw Camelot, even if you've never read King Arthur. Probably know about the story. Lord Lancelot who loved the queen, That was a bad one. Well, she said, we were alone. We thought no harm at all. As we read on, our eyes met now and then. And to our cheeks the change in color started. But just one moment overcame us. When we read of a smile, desired of lips long thwarted, such smile by such a lover kissed away, he that may never more from me be parted, trembling all over, kissed my mouth. I say, the book was Gallio, the complying ribald who wrote. We read no more that day. You need any more? I spelled out for you. Now, I think what's important about this, the reason I took time with this one, is that it isn't so very far from, you know, our society, is it? I suppose we've seen it in 150,000 movies and books and stories and newspaper stories. And you know, Francesca, is she willing to say, you know, it was our fault, we should never have done it. Even if we wanted to, it wasn't right. No, she said, well, that was, you know, that man that wrote the book, you know, he did it. He shouldn't have written a book like that. Nobody should have given us a book like that to read. And, well, we didn't read the book anymore, but, you know, it was all accomplished anyway, you know, all the seeds were planted in our spirits. We'd already fallen in love with each other. And so, of course, what happened, really, and it was an actual event, was that the husband came back and killed them both. Because the affair kept on for a while. Well, there were some things about that affair that were not all that, you know, you could see some, there were some things that were, you know, you could see why Francesca could say that it wasn't all her fault. Because it was one of these arranged marriages. But this does not come into the decision when it's a matter of right and wrong. You could have a lot of reasons for not doing it or for doing it. But when you come right down to the end, what sends you to hell is whether you decide to do it. And justification of your position, excuses aren't going to help. And this is what Dante is so good at. And what he does by saying that these two are going to float together for the rest of their lives and it's going to be an eternity in hell is that it's just a continual kind of never, sort of like what happened with our friend last night, you know, never really having the girl, never really relating to the person because they're just continually on the wings of passion and they had no real right to each other. Because they were stealing each other, and Dante is so good about making it. You know, he just doesn't say too much. It's just enough so that you think, oh, that didn't just happen in Florence. It happened a lot of other places. Then he has another remarkable one in the not very far from this one, in which he talks about gluttony, and. The thing about gluttony is that he doesn't talk about it. He emphasizes the fact that when you think about, oh, you know, I love to eat, I love to drink, I love to enjoy life, I like a good standard of living, you know, from the point of view of the present, it looks great. It looks, you know, it's a good way to live, you know. But if you carry that to its nth degree, so that other people are starved because I am, you know, living in this high standard of living and allowing everything to come my way, that finally, in the end, the hell that happens to the fellow that is in this particular spot is a bad one. This is what it says. Oh, the note on this is good. He lives in a rainy place, just nothing but cold rain. And he says, gluttony, like the other self-indulgences it typifies, often masquerades on earth as a warm, cozy, and indeed a jolly kind of sin. Here it is seen as it is, a cold sensuality, a sodden and filthy spiritual wretchedness. This is the way, when you look at it, this is the description of it. I am now in the third circle, that of rain, one ceaseless, heavy, cold, accursed quench, whose law and nature vary never of rain, huge hailstones, sleet and snow, and turbid drench of water, sluice down through the darkened air, and the soaked earth gives off a putrid stench. Cerberus, the cruel, misshapen monster, there bays in his triple gullet, and dog-like growls over the wallowing shades. His eyeballs glare a bloodshot crimson, and his bearded jowls are greasy and black. Pot-bellied, talon-heeled, he clutches and flays and rips and rends the souls. They howl in the rain like hounds. They try to shield one flank with the other. With many a twist and squirm, the impious wretches writhe in the filthy field. And this is the way these people look, who on earth have been just, you know, looked like they were just, you know, being having a really good time, but they've always been shutting out other people. It hasn't been the kind of coziness that included. It's been the kind of coziness that was really totally for the self, totally egocentric, totally self-indulgent. And this is what that whole circle is about. Chaco, you citizens, nicknamed me, alack. Damnable gluttony was my soul's disease. See how I waste for it now in the rain's wrath. And I, poor sinner, am not alone. All these lie bound in the like penalty with me for the like offense. And there he held his peace. The interesting thing about hell is that there is no community. The farther you get down into hell, the more solitary is the suffering. There's no communication from one circle to the next. There's no communication between people. Heaven is all intercommunication. It's all community. Hell is isolation. And this is borne home more and more as you read through the Inferno, that even at the first, the upper circles, like with Paolo and Francesca, as Dante says, the lust is bad enough, but at least, to begin with, at least it's a shared love. It's not something that's just solitary. But gradually, as you get farther and farther into the worst of the sins of the flesh and the spirit, things get more and more removed so that you finally are unable to communicate with anybody. And that's why when you get to Satan himself, he is frozen in the sea of glass with no way of speaking or talking or communicating to anybody, because that's what happens when you finally lose all contact with that which is of God, which is the outgoing of love. I was going to read one little bit too from the beginning here, because this vestibule part is so much fun. It's not fun, but I think that it's interesting. When the souls of the dead are going to come to hell, they arrive at the gate, and over the gate of hell is this inscription: through me the road to the city of desolation, through me the road to sorrows diuturnal, through me the road among the lost creation. Justice moved my great maker, God eternal wrought me, the power and the unsearchably high wisdom, and the primal love supernal. Nothing ere I was made to be save things eternal, and I eternal abide. Lay down all hope, you that go in by me. Now these were written above the gateway to hell. Abandon hope, all you who enter here. That's the way we a lot of us remember it and have heard it, and probably didn't know we were quoting Dante. But when you get to that point, you realize that this entrance, in a real sense, Dante says this entrance was made by God. But it was made by God not with the idea of its being a place of hell, but because of the way in which people used it and chose to use it, it became that, because it became a way away from God instead of through to Him. And Dante says here, we've reached the place, Virgil says this, we've reached the place I told you to expect, where thou shouldst see the miserable race, those who have lost the good of intellect. Those who have lost the good of intellect. Now, by the good of intellect, Dante doesn't mean people who are brainy and smart and high IQs and so on. He means people who have stopped being what Charles Williams called, what I refer to as being accurate. People who have stopped paying attention to their lives. Stop paying attention to the fact that life has to be lived as before God. And when you do that, you lose the totality of your human beingness. And the story of hell and even some parts of purgatory is where intellect, because you still have your mind will still work, and it will do a lot of terrible things to you. But the good of it is gone. It no longer is the creative power that it was made to be. And so you've lost the good of intellect when you come to the vestibule of hell and you still have not given over that intellect to the Lord and repented, then you've lost the good of it, and just like your body is there, your intellect is there, your senses are still there, but they're all going to be perverted because they're no longer connected with the source of goodness, which is God. And this line in Dante, I think, is one of the most important. The miserable race, those who have lost the good of intellect. And then they come to this vestibule, and there he says, who are these people so distraught with grief? And he says, the dismal company of wretched spirits thus find their guerdon due, whose lives knew neither praise nor infamy. They were nice people, good, decent people who didn't need to repent. They didn't need God. They were all right. They voted. They paid their taxes. They didn't get into trouble. They're mingled with that caitiff angel crew who against God rebelled not, nor to him were faithful, but to self alone were true. You get that? These people in the vestibule are not people that have done any wild, dramatic, violent sins that you remember, like Jezebel or Lady Macbeth or people of that nature. But they are people who knew neither praise nor infamy. People who didn't need any repentance. They weren't good, decent people. But of course, they always looked out for themselves. After all, if I don't look out for myself, who will? You know, that's the principle of life, isn't it? And that's what, and that's why they got stuck in hell. Because we didn't want to go to hell, really. We didn't plan it. That's where they are. Because they neither rebelled nor were faithful. And you know, remember that line in Revelation, because you were neither hot nor cold, because you're lukewarm, I cast you, spew you out of my mouth. And you get spewed out into the vestibule to hell. This dreary huddle has no hope of death, yet its blind life trails on so low and crass that every other faith is envious. No reputation in the world it has. Mercy and doom hold it alike in scorn. Let us not speak of these, but look and pass. And then when Donkey is going to be ferried over to hell, there's a river. You know, of course, all the classical pictures of the final place of the soul always had a river, and it was the river Lethe, which made you forget everything, so that when you went across it, you wouldn't carry anything from this world, and if you went back, you wouldn't carry anything from the underworld back into the present. But there has to be a river here too, and so there he stands, and the old man Charon, who is the is ferrying him over the river Styx this time, says, "I'm not going to take him. He's alive. He's got a body." And Virgil says, "You know, if to get him across anyway." So finally, he gets across all right. But they have to put Dante to sleep so that he doesn't know that he's going across, because then he's almost like he's dead. And it's on, and Dark Sayer says in one of the notes that this is the way we sometimes go to hell. We sleep our way into it. We haven't made any decisions to go. No. We haven't made any decisions to stay out of it either. And so because of that, we just kind of fall into the trap and get carried along, and there we are. Lovely to be in the inferno the rest of eternity. It's quite a way in which you have a vision of your own particular situation in terms of your relationship with hell and the final decision of your life. Dante is always very, very positive about the fact that there's always a place for deathbed repentances. He's not going to ever shut anybody off. In fact, he says one place that there is no way that heaven can be denied anyone who truly desires God. God will never cut himself off from anyone who wants it. No matter how much he stumbles, no matter how far he gets back in the slews of despond and ditches, if he really desires it, nothing can separate him from that. And that's, you know, that goes all the way through there. But that's not true of the people in hell. The people in hell are there, and that's it. But when he gets to purgatory, the beginning, I have to read you this beginning just before we close, because it is a great line and gives you a feeling of a different kind of vision almost of what the rest of the poem is going to be about. The poem takes place, by the way, during Holy Week. It starts on Holy Thursday night and goes through Good Friday and Easter Saturday. In fact, Easter Saturday, when I had a terrible cold, I read through Purgatory again, and it was really something. This is the end of the Inferno ends this way, and it's Easter Sunday morning at 5:00. There is a place low down there underground, as far from Beelzebub as his tomb is deep, not known to sight, but only to the sound of a small stream which trickles down the steep, hollowing its channel, where with gentle fall and devious course its wandering waters creep. By that hid way, my guide and I, withal, back to the lit world, from the darkened dens toiled upward, caring for no rest at all. When you go down with Dante into the bottom of hell, it's so terrible that you wonder if you're ever going to get out of it, really. And he says that they toiled upward, caring for no rest. They were so anxious to get out of it. He first, I following, till my straining sense glimpsed the bright burden of the heavenly cars through a round hole. By this we climbed, and thence came forth to look once more upon the stars. Just think, See, they've been in this terrible under earth place, and suddenly they come out and look once more upon the stars. And when they look on the stars, that means that from that time on, you know, it's all going to be up. It may be long and it may be slow, but the vision is there and it's going to be up, and they're going to move gradually to paradise. And I think that line of Annie, it sort of symbolizes for me the feeling you get of the opening up that there is in the Christian life, and that Donnie wants you to realize that hell is freezing. It's like a vice that holds you in, and that as you come out into the open, that then you can look up and you see the stars again, and you know that there is a way that's been made ahead for you. It's really a great experience to read this book, and I would recommend most strongly that if you read any of them, that you probably should read The Inferno, because it is the easiest to grab to, you know, if you can make it a part of yourself. And Dorothy Sayers' translation is such that you get a good feeling from it, and she has awfully good notes that explain anything that you're not sure of. But if you can allow yourself to really become a part of it, you can just let it happen to you, and you don't have to know what everything is that's going on. Just kind of get what you can out of it. And then if you want to go back and really go in and study it, then you can do that. But really, you can get quite a lot out of it, and it will speak to your condition, even if you just read along through it and don't take too much time to try to figure out all the double meanings and the political inferences and so on. It's the kind of book that I would say should be in everybody's memory and everybody's mind somewhere, so that it can come up, bob up like to the top once in a while when you need that kind of a remembrance to help you with the guardians of your threshold over your conscious life, so that your life does really become lit by the stars and the promises of God.